Thanks for coming.
Yeah, again, awesome to have so many people here so early in the morning. Obviously, you didn't have big nights, which is sensible. Well done. So I'm going to talk to you today about the power of a great API, and more specifically, why you should think about writing an API for your own application. And if you're doing a file new project, why you should think about the API first, more than the UI. So that's today's talk. I like these talks because you'd probably be aware the ones you've been to as well at Ignite and other events like that, they're largely kind of product pitches to an extent. And this one is not product pitch at all. I'm using Visual Studio and I'm using some libraries in NuGet and stuff like that with the demos, but you'll see when I get to the slides that most of the logos and most of the other sites that I reference and things aren't Microsoft ones. So it's kind of good to talk a little bit less product and a bit more software development. So who would consider themselves a software dev? I'm assuming pretty much everybody in the room. Yeah. Anybody would not consider themselves a dev? Three people who are half not devs. Team leads, IT pro. Yep. That wasn't a very good question because it could have been either. All right, so today, this is what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about first why an API is a good thing. So try and sell you on the idea of writing an API for your application, even if you're sitting there thinking, well, this is going to be cool, but I'm not going to end up writing an API. I hope that I can convince you otherwise. We're going to look at some implementation details. So not necessarily around how you specifically write your code, but how you structure your API and some things you need to worry about and stuff like that. And then at the end, I'm going to look at a demo. So we're basically just going to go file new project, create an API. But I was talking to somebody yesterday and they said that in all of these sessions, it's great, the developer gets up there or the presenter gets up there, they open Visual Studio, do file new project and do their stuff. And everybody watches and goes, yeah, that's cool. And then they go back home and back to their workplace and they work on the product that they've been working on solidly for the last 6 years. It's not a file new project. I'm doing a lot of the raising their hands thing. It keeps you awake. Who's done a file new project in the last 6 months? Ooh, wow, okay. Last 2 months? Oh, maybe I'm wrong. Who hasn't done one in the last year? Okay, so there's still a fair few. All right. Well, hopefully, so I added a demo yesterday, which is always what they tell presenters to do. Added a demo yesterday, which will hopefully convince the people who don't do file new projects that this is something that they can actually add to their application. So we're going to do that. All right, so I work for a company called Octopus Deploy, and at Octopus, all of us do support. So all of the devs do support, which kind of keeps us honest. It means that we write better code because that's going to come back to us if we don't. But it also means we learn the kind of problems that customers are having with the product, which is really good. We've got one main support person, Vanessa, who's awesome, has a dev background, and is the only support person I've met so far where you can say, how does this thing work? And she'll tell you how it works under the covers before you can look at the code. But everybody kind of gets involved, which means that we get support questions. And one of the first questions I got was this one when I started at Octopus, which is we need one button to disable all the machines in the environment. Does anyone, who uses Octopus? Anyone? Okay, a few people. So for the ones who don't, it's basically a deployment automation bit of software. So you define your environments, your dev, test, staging, production, and then you define your machines. So you talk about the deployment targets. So you have a few machines. You might have your like one dev machine in the dev environment, and then when you get to staging, you have a couple of web servers and some application servers. In production, you might have a farm of them and so on. So it kind of looks like this. So we've got our development environment, one machine, test environment, two machines. And they wanted to disable the machines, all the machines in an environment. So here's how you do it using the UI. You basically go up to find the machine, you click on it, you scroll down, and then there's like a disable checkbox. So you check that, you click save, and that comes back and you've disabled the machine, right? Pretty straightforward. But what if your environment looks like this? They had 200 machines in their environment. Now this is, for people who do support, this is what we call a bit of a snowflake. I don't know what that square box below that is actually. Interesting. It's not on my deck. This is a snowflake scenario. So this doesn't happen very often. You don't disable machines very often. Like, it's pretty rare. Normally you'd remove them and recreate them again. So we didn't really build in a disable all the machines button or anything like that. So the solutions, traditionally, there'd be a couple of answers to this question. The first one is, sorry, you're going to have to do that thing 200 times. Like, that's generally the reaction. Everybody gets upset. Like, we're upset because we've disappointed a customer. The customer's upset because they needed to do this thing. We've just made it really hard for them. The alternative solution is, yeah, cool. That sounds like a great feature that maybe three people will use. Sure, we'll add it to the product. And that's how you get things like this. So that's a bad idea as well. So we basically went, well, there's no way we're adding this to the product. Like, nobody ever uses this. But because Octopus Deploy is an API-first application, and by API-first, I mean that the UI is simply a web layer over the top. It's an Angular app that gets downloaded the first time you hit the site. And then after that, it just hits the API, exactly the same as you would hit the API if you're calling it from a third-party application. Because it was API first, we could say, sure, here's a script you can use. So I wrote some JavaScript, which will just, this only works in Chrome, and actually it doesn't even work in the current version. It's a little bit old, but I basically gave them a gist in GitHub and said, use this, open the console thing in Chrome, paste it in, press enter, and then you get these two buttons. So all those buttons do, this is just some JavaScript to inject some HTML, but those buttons just iterate through, they call the API, say what machines are in this environment, they get those machines back, and they iterate through them, and they save them all with a disabled flag enabled. So it's not in the UI, but it's something I could add to the UI in maybe 20 minutes of work. And that way everybody's happy, right? The customer's happy because they've got this thing that they want. And I'm happy because, you know, we've pleased the customer and we haven't had to, compromise our application. So that's kind of one scenario, and this comes up a lot, actually. We do this kind of thing a lot. If you have a look at the gist or the GitHubs of all of the Octopus employees, you'll find a bunch of gists that are just either PowerShell scripts or, bits of JavaScript and things like that we've just given to customers to say, yeah, the UI doesn't have it, but just hit the API, it'll be fine. So that's really powerful. That's one way of doing it. The important thing to note here is that you're writing an API. So API, obviously, everybody would know, stands for Application Programming Interface. So you have a user interface, so the thing that the user uses, and an application programming interface. So anything that's an application can use this API, right? So really what you're doing is you're kind of exposing this generic plug that other stuff can plug into. So like the lamps in your house, for example, aren't hardwired to the house power, they're plugged into a PowerPoint. If somebody wants to write a device or create a device that can plug into that endpoint, they can. And that's exactly how it works. And it means that if you don't want to write some stuff for your application, but there's a chance that somebody else will, it's really powerful because they can write that functionality, and then you can get the benefit from it and they can get the benefit from it as well. So there's a couple of apps that give an example of this. And so these are iPhone apps. There's one called iOctocat, which is basically just an iPhone app that sits over the top of the GitHub API. So you can browse through your GitHub repos, have a look at issues, do things like that. That's not written by GitHub, that's written by somebody else. Somebody else just calls the GitHub API, they create an app and they release the app. The one on the left is a Reddit, who uses Reddit? No, I'm not gonna ask you actually. Everybody does and nobody admits it. It's a Reddit app called Alien Blue on iPhone, and that is actually the official Reddit app for iPhone, but Reddit didn't write it. Somebody else wrote this app, it became really popular, and Reddit went, cool, we might buy it then. So they got the advantage of getting a really good iPhone app that they didn't have to put any effort into apart from handing over cash. And it's because they had an open API, so an API that other people could hit. Speaking of Twitter, which I wasn't really, but who knows what Twitter did with developers? I'm looking out for David Golden here. Is he in the room? Nope. Cool. So Twitter actually has a really good API, but a little while ago they kind of restricted it. So if you're ever on Windows 8 on the early builds and things like that, you might have known a Windows 8 app called MetroTwit, which was written by David Golden and David Zeng, I think, as well. Sorry, not David Zeng, Long Zen. And it was a really good Twitter like client for Windows. But if you have a look at the top, you probably can't read that, but it basically says MetroTwit has been discontinued and download is no longer available, and a link to read the announcement. What the announcement boils down to is Twitter decided that people shouldn't really use their API anymore, and so they just restricted it in ways that meant that this app wasn't feasible anymore. So Twitter basically crippled all of these third-party developers who were using their platform. Now, their reasons for it were kind of legitimate, I guess. They wanted to control their advertising and things like that. Twitter was one of these apps that had hundreds of thousands and millions of users, but ultimately didn't make any money from it, so they've got to monetize at some point. So their reasons were there, but they annoyed a lot of developers. And this was only fairly recently that the Twitter CEO apologized to developers and said, look, we screwed up, we did a bad thing. Because they annoyed a lot of people, right? They had this API and they pulled it, not really pulled it, but they restricted it so people couldn't really use it anymore. So they've worked out that was a mistake. Who uses this app? Anyone? Like four people. Who drinks beer? More people, okay. This is like a competition for drinking beer, which is a terrible, don't like compete. That's, I'm glad you put the camera away actually. So Untappd is basically a social drinking app. It's a thing where you say, I am drinking this beer in this location. And you get points for different numbers of beers and badges and things like that. And there's some people who just go nuts. Jake Ginnivan, is he in here? He's got a lot of points. It's a social drinking thing, like a social media app. But they pull information from Foursquare. So Foursquare, which is the kind of location app, it's all these places. You check into a place and say, I'm at Ignite and having a great time, all that sort of stuff. So that's a social thing as well. But they pull location data from Foursquare. So they didn't have to build their own thing. And the reason they can do that is because Foursquare has an API. They also push these notifications out to Twitter and Facebook, so all the people not on Untappd know that you're drinking, which is cool. So all this API is connecting up, really good. But I found another one a little while ago somebody notified me of called NowTappd. And it's just a website. It basically lists for all of these like pubs and breweries that have all of these different craft beers on tap. It lists what craft beers are on tap at that time, at this particular location. So they rotate a lot, obviously, craft beers, small nano breweries and all the hipster stuff. So this will tell you what beers are on, but not every pub's gonna give them that information. So they pull data from Untappd and see what beers people are checking in at what location, so they can give you a rough idea of what's probably on tap at a particular location. So you got this chain of like all these APIs calling each other and building on each other and so on. It makes a really great ecosystem. And a lot of companies are kind of starting to do this. So, see a ton of logos here. That one up top left is no longer correct. It's not Visual Studio Online anymore. But I couldn't find a new logo. Anyway, I could have got the old VSTS logo. That would have been good. But all of these guys have an API. Now, not all of them are public APIs, or not all of them are APIs that you can just hit from anywhere. So, like Xero, for example, and Myob. They might have a public API, but it's pretty useless until you can authenticate. So you can hit the API, but you still need to pay them money. So if you're worried about, so all the other examples, Twitter and Facebook and all those kind of things, they have APIs, but they're kind of free to use, so there's no money in them. A lot of these ones, you still buy the software, but you have to hit the API and authenticate for it to make any money. So that's kind of an important point, is that an API doesn't necessarily have to be a public API. So if you're thinking that's all cool, but we're not writing a public-facing app, we're writing an internal thing, an API is still very useful. All the way back in 2002, Jeff Bezos, the Amazon CEO, I think, he basically wrote this email to all his employees, which more or less said, everything that each team does, you have to expose your data via an API. The important bit is the bit that I'd circled there, which is anyone who doesn't do it will be fired, have a nice day, which is pleasant, right? But basically, all the way back in 2002, he said, even though the vast majority of our stuff is internal, we need to expose this stuff to all the other teams. And so they have this web of APIs internally, and this is kind of the microservices stuff that you keep seeing. It's the idea of having an application or a little bit of your application data which is exposed via an API, so other applications can use it, which is really powerful. So they got into this quite early. All right. Before we move on to some implementation details and get into a bit of the guts of it, does anybody have any questions so far? I mean, I've just been talking about stuff, so there's probably nothing there. No questions. There's somebody raising their hand. People keep raising their hands for people coming in the door. Anyone want chocolate? All right. So well, that's all cool. Everybody thinks, yeah, API is an awesome thing. I want to go and do it now, I assume. I'm very persuasive. So implementation details. So everybody writes their application with layers and dependency injection and all that kind of stuff, right? Yep. nervous nods. So it's kind of like this proverbial iceberg thing. Overused analogy, but it's pretty appropriate. You kind of have your UI is the bit that sits above the water. Business layer, data layer, your exceptions kind of fall into this deep abyss. But the bit that everybody sees is this UI on the top, right? That's just the surface of the iceberg. But most of the work happens underneath. So when I'm talking about exposing an API for your application, what I'm really talking about is just kind of pushing the business layer slightly above the surface of the water. So now the stuff that the user's still just going to see the UI, but other applications have the ability to see into your business layer a little bit. So I'm really just talking about exposing your business layer, which means that you probably have to design the surface of your business layer a little bit better, or you have to at least think about it. So if you're doing your file new project and you're starting a new application, you have the ability to say, I'm going to do API first. It basically looks more like this. You want to focus on your function rather than your user interface. So instead of thinking about your customer details screen, you think about your customer detail function. Or your add customer screen becomes your add customer function. And you think about how you would want to access that if it was a third-party library, something like that. So you have your layers. Your data layer on the bottom, business layer, whatever layers you use, it's a simplification. And then you have your API on the top. The API should be a nice, clean thing that programmers can access. And your UI should ideally sit on top of your own API. That way, when your screen, your add customer screen, calls the add customer method or the add customer endpoint, it would be exactly the same as a third-party application or another application inside your organization calling that same API. And that way there's no surprises, right? It's not a case of, I added a customer from the UI and it's totally different from when I added it from the payroll system, for example. So that's really important. Now, for those people who don't do file new project, so the API second kind of thing, you already have your layers, right? You've got your UI and it's tied into your business layer and it's obviously really decoupled because everybody does that. And the data layer on the bottom. You kind of still want to expose your business layer. So there's going to be a lot of refactoring here. And that's just the reality of it. You kind of want to refactor or add this API layer and ideally do the same thing. Get your UI to go through your API. Now, that's not always possible. If it's not possible, then you want to make sure your API exposes the same endpoint. So you don't want these surprises. So ideally, your API then should be a really, really narrow layer over the top of your business layer. So your UI can call the business layer methods, but your API endpoints should basically just reflect what the business layer methods are. So if you call them, it's going to go through the same code path. You don't want two separate code paths for your API and for your UI. That's really important. Cool. So there's a few ways to expose your API. And I'm going to clarify a couple of things here. There's plenty of options, but HTTP is kind of the easiest way. And everybody talks about web APIs. It's not the only option, though. And basically, anything that an application can access is a legitimate API, right? So don't let any, like, don't go away with the misconception that everything I'm talking about is the only way to do APIs with web endpoints. That's not actually true. Even like with the Octopus installer, the endpoint of the installer wizard or the setup wizard is a series of PowerShell scripts, or not PowerShell even, just command line scripts. We call an executable with some arguments. And that means that everything is scriptable. That's still an API. You can still call that from another application. It's not something that you'd traditionally think is an API, but ultimately it is. It's something that another application can call. It can just call some command line arguments. So we're exposing the same thing. So you can do stuff like that. Obviously, you can give people a DLL, and that does some magic under the covers. If you're really, like, if you're feeling too good about yourself, you can use WCF or something. I wouldn't recommend that. And it's really easy to actually add these HTTP endpoints to an existing application. So who writes for WinForms or XAML or something like that? Okay, yeah, a few hands. So you guys are probably sitting there just going, oh great, it's gonna be a web API talk. This is completely irrelevant. It's not completely irrelevant, and I'll show you. This is the demo at the end. It's really, really easy to add an HTTP endpoint to an existing application, whether it's web or not. And the way I'm doing it at the moment is just Owen and Nancy. Who's heard of Nancy or NancyFX? Yeah, okay, a few people. It's basically a really lightweight web framework. And it doesn't have to sit on Owen. Everybody aware of Owen? It was kind of the precursor to, well, kind of the precursor to the ASP.NET pipeline, ASP.NET 5 pipeline. So you can kind of use that as well. But I generally just use Owen and Nancy, and with these two commands. Microsoft Owen self-host, and that means you don't need IIS. It will just host it out of anything that runs. And then Nancy will sit on top of Owen as well. So those are really easy ways to do that. You see people taking photos and writing stuff down, so I'll just pause for a sec. And I'll show you this a couple of times, how easy it is. All right, so assuming we're using web APIs, the types of web APIs, there's a few different ways you can do it. The older method, the one that people used to use a lot, was HTTP RPC, so remote procedure calls, which is ultimately just calling methods over HTTP. So that's a real case of exposing your business layer, essentially. You just call a method. And it's request response because it's over the web, right? So even if you're calling a function that doesn't return anything, you've still got to return an acknowledgement. You can't just let it drop, really. So that's one way. I'm not saying any of these are not legitimate. REST is the one that everybody knows, but nobody actually really knows. Everybody's got really strong opinions on what REST is. It stands for representational every single time I say that word. Representational state transfer. And it's essentially resource-based URI. So you have a customer resource, and then you use an HTTP verb like get to say, give me this customer. So everything's based around these things that you want to get or save or delete or whatever. And the other thing is it's stateless, which is what everybody talks about with REST, which means that you shouldn't have a server state at all. Each request should exist by itself. So there's that. There's another one which is kind of an extension of REST called HADOS. Colors are a little bit wrong. This is the best acronym in the world. It's Hypermedia as the Engine of Application State. And it's basically, the simplification of it is it's REST plus some links. So it's the resource-based stuff, plus here's some other stuff that's related to that resource. So you might have a customer resource, so you do a get on the customer, and it'll say, here's your customer details. Also, here's the URL you go to get the customer's orders, and here's the URL you go to get their addresses, and here's how you cancel that customer and all these things. So that's an addition to it as well. And that's really powerful. So, which one do you use? And this is something that you'll see me say a lot, which is that you should just be pragmatic about what you do. We'll talk about that in a sec. Just as an example of these ones, so Flickr, the Flickr API uses the RPC kind of method. So here's an example. You can see it says REST in the URL, but it's not. REST, and here's the method that I want you to call. So you're calling the flickr.photos.search method and you're passing in some arguments and it's giving you back some results. And this is XML, you can ask for JSON, but that's an example of a kind of an RPT thing. You're asking it to call a method, passing some arguments. The Spotify API has a pretty much a RESTful one. So you're asking for the artist resource and giving it an ID, and it will give you the details about that artist. Anyone know who that is? Nope. Yeah, John Farnham. I typed that out by memory. So this does have some URLs, but they're not really Haydos kind of URLs. They're like, here's the link to open it in Spotify. Yep, fine. Here's some images. But there's no like, here's the albums by John Farnham, or here's the songs, or here are the people who have them in their playlist, or any of that kind of stuff. It's still very much here's data without the links. And the GitHub API is a really good one for the Haydos style as well. So a lot of the Haydos style APIs have the idea where you hit the base API and it goes, here's all of the things that I can do. Here's all of the URLs. So you can see you hit api.github.com and it gives you a whole lot of a list of links that you can go to. Most of them won't make sense unless you authorize, but there's some really useful ones like the emojis one. And if you hit that, you get all the emojis and images. So if you want to just add that to your internal chat applications, you could probably just take it from GitHub. But that's an idea. That's the idea of, you know, here are the links that are relevant to what you're trying to do. So again, just be pragmatic about what you do. It's all very well and good to say we're going to go REST, but sometimes the things that you want to expose don't really fit neatly into this resource-based system. So there might be operations you want to kick off, and you could force that into a RESTful thing to say, well, let's create an operations request object, and then I'll create one of those, and then that will give me a link to a operation completion object and stuff. You're kind of forcing yourself into the REST paradigm, and you don't really need to. So be a bit pragmatic about what you do. Ultimately, that means you'll probably end up with something like good CRUD for resources, which is fine, plus some other functions for things that you want to do. CRUD basically corresponds to, in HTTP verbs, post, get, put, delete. Create, read, update, delete are those kind of verbs. So you want to do you start to get into some problems as well about what objects look like. So let's say we're calling a customer's API and we're asking for customer number one. And we say this is the object we get back, right? We've got a first name, last name, date of birth, email, stuff like that. And then you think, well, customers also have addresses, so maybe I will add the addresses to it as well. And then they also have orders, maybe I'll add orders to it as well. And you start getting this gigantic amount of information when somebody really maybe just hit your API to get the person's name. So you've got to think about how much data you return. And there's a few ways to do that. You can say, here's a link to the addresses and let them get that themselves. You can say, there's different levels of detail. Do I want the basic customer one or do I want all of them? Have different, like multiple levels of detail, things like that. It's really hard to tell kind of upfront, especially if you're exposing your API purely for the purposes of other people calling it. I personally don't have too much of a problem with giving people the specific information they've asked for and making them go and get the rest of it. So I'd probably stick to the first one, here's the basic customer details and here's some links to get their addresses. Might end up with a lot of hits, but you'll start to notice that and say, well, okay, maybe we'll add some detail to it as well. We'll get to versioning in a sec. And again, once again, be pragmatic. What makes sense for your organization? If nobody ever gets customers without wanting their addresses, then include the addresses in the object. It makes sense. One thing I will say, though, is use separate classes for the data that comes back. So don't just expose your business objects. Create new API objects and return them. And the reason is pretty sensible. If your business layer changes, and so your business objects change, you don't want to break the API. There might be five applications calling your API. You don't want them to suddenly fail. All right. So there's a few other options for retrieving data as well. Who's heard of OData? Anyone? Yeah? Okay. I don't like OData. I think it's terrible. The very first Visual Studio, so back then it was Team Foundation Service. So that was like two names ago. The very first API they exposed for that was an OData endpoint, and they basically took it down because what this does is it gives the caller the ability to define the query that was running. And if anybody's queried against TFS before, you know that sometimes it's not the fastest thing in the world. And so people were kind of like chewing up resources on Visual Studio Online. And so they kind of had to take it down. And that's why I don't like it. You're kind of giving the control to the caller. You really want to dictate what people can get out of your application a bit more. That's my personal opinion. So this one, for example, will get the top five customers by the total amount that they've ordered, as long as it's over $10,000 or something like that. So if your database doesn't optimize this kind of query, then somebody might hammer your machine and accidentally denial of service you. So that's why I don't like it. There's also another option which Facebook kind of came up with called GraphQL. Has anybody seen this? Yeah, a couple of hands. So the people who put their hands up probably know a lot more about it than me. So correct me if I'm wrong. But I'm pretty sure it's a similar idea, except you, when you make the request, you define the shape of the data that you want back. So that earlier example I gave of do you return the addresses and the orders with the customer, that comes in the request. So you say, I want the customers, but I also want these fields for the addresses, and I want the top three orders, and here's the shape of the data that I want back. And it's kind of a nice idea. The biggest thing for me is I have no idea how you'd implement something like that. Like, you have to build this dynamic object based on the request. It seems really difficult to do, but it'd be interesting to see what they come up with there. Was I about right, by the way? Yep, awesome. Okay, just before we move on to these other things that might hurt, because this slide is like a conference in itself, does anybody have any questions about stuff I've talked about so far? Yeah? So PubSub APIs, so things like webhooks and that kind of two-way situation. I'm not really going to talk about, so the question was, what about PubSub kind of APIs? I'm not really going to talk about them so much. I will mention it in a sec, actually, but there is the option of doing things like notify me when this thing happens and having a two-way relationship between your application and the other one. Those are definitely options as well. And in fact, that's probably a good opportunity. So long-running tasks is something that you quite often encounter. So you might need a report generation thing, which would normally take 5 minutes, for example. And you don't want to hit an HTTP endpoint and then wait 5 minutes for your response to come back. That's not really how you'd expect the web to work. So there's a few different techniques, and one of them is this kind of pub-sub model where you say, I want you to create a report, and then when you're finished, call this endpoint or hit me back and tell me that you've finished. Yeah?
Your comment about keeping duplicates of your API level objects, the business layer objects, I think the opposite.
Oh.
Opinion on the basis that we've seen so many bugs where people have forgotten to update fields from one and not the other. Do you have any recommendations on how to overcome that?
So the question was, or the comment was that the comment I made about having completely separate objects from your business objects for your API, so your API returning different objects, and essentially duplication, that you have the complete opposite opinion of how that should go, because people will add stuff to a business object but not add it to the API or vice versa and things like that. And that's a legitimate thing. And that, to be honest, that kind of comes down to how your team operates. So if a lot of people are making a lot of changes and then the API breaks, that's stuff that should ideally be taken care of by tests, I think. This is my opinion, by the way, so this is all opinion. Don't take this as fact. I think it's more important personally to make sure that you don't break your API. So if you have unit tests and things like that, they should also hit your API. So as an example, the Octopus stuff, we do have unit tests, that's fine, but the vast majority of the testing we do is after build and it hits the API and makes sure that it gets what it expects. So if you have tests like that, that's where those things can kind of come up. But yes, it's not something that can kind of be done automatically. If you do expose your pure business objects, then when somebody changes them, they will come through the API as well. But then you're much more likely to hurt the apps that are calling your API, because you're changing the contract that they expect, essentially. It is give and take, though. I mean, if If you have a lot of control over those apps, maybe it's better for you to expose those business objects. I personally don't like that idea. I would prefer to see it break internally rather than break somebody else's stuff. But yeah, it is a good point. Cool. The other way you can do long-running tasks is return an object like, yes, I'm doing this thing, check back later. Here's a URL where you can keep hitting me. And this is kind of the RESTful model. And then after a while, when you hit that resource, it'll come back and say, here you go, and here's a link to the resource. So, but yeah, the other one that Robert mentioned as well was the subscription kind of thing where you can say, I am interested in these things that happen. So that's kind of the webhook idea, and Visual Studio Team Services has that idea as well. You can set up webhooks. GitHub has webhooks as well, so you can be notified when things happen. I'm not really going to talk about that, but that's definitely an option as well for this two-way communication. Security, there's entire conferences on API security, so I'm not going to talk about it much. What I am going to say, though, is it's something you need to think about really early. So don't think that this is something you can just gloss over. One really good way of doing it as well is personal access tokens. So GitHub does this. It's basically me as a user will create a one-time token or a kind of a token that another application can use and act as me on my behalf. So GitHub has this. Visual Studio Team Services also has this. And you can also often define scopes. So even though I have full admin access, when somebody uses this token, they're acting as me, but they're only allowed to, for example, read work items. So those are really powerful as well. And they're actually really secure, because as long as you're going over HTTPS and things like that, they're acting as you, but if they get leaked or somebody gets hold of them, you can just revoke them and they will just no longer work anymore. And it kind of takes away a lot of the problems with things like OAuth and single sign-on and all that kind of token-based stuff. So these are really powerful. So have a look at those. The question was, are they implemented on top of JWTs? Sometimes. Often they're much simpler, though. And I don't think they really need to be on top of JWTs. So Java Web Tokens is basically a representation of the identity. Is that right? So so here's a token, and embedded in this token is some details about the identity and a signature so you know that it's come from a legitimate place, that kind of thing. Yeah. So it basically consists of a payload to say more or less what's on that screen, pretty much, but also signed so that you know it's legitimate. You can implement them like that, but often it's just as easy to say, here's a GUID that I just created, and just store that in a table against the user's name and any other permissions. So that when you hit the API, it goes, oh, I got this ID. Is that in the user, like, personal access token list? Yeah, it is. Oh, it's this guy. Okay, we'll authenticate as that guy. JWTs are really useful for if your authentication and identity stuff happens outside that application as well. So if you're using AAD or Azure Active Directory or other single sign-on stuff, that's really handy that way. So yeah, you can do it like that, but you don't have to. All right, I'm conscious of time and I want to show demos. Everybody wants to see demos. So versioning is something I kind of touched on, and that kind of comes down to breaking your contract. So if you change what the API looks like or the data that comes back, that's a difficult thing to manage. Think about how you're going to handle this first. And again, there's tons of stuff out there. If you have a Pluralsight subscription, by the way, there's a really good chapter in a course by Sean Wildermuth, where he talks about lots of different methods of API versioning. So that's, yeah, Sean Wildermuth. He's probably got blog posts on the thing as well, but it's a really good way of doing it. But you got to think about how you handle different versions of your API, because as much as you say we're not going to change our contract, you will have to change your contract. You'll have to change what your API looks like at some point. Caching is pretty useful as well, because it is just the web. You know, if your query takes a long time, then maybe return a cached version every now and then. The important thing to remember, though, is if somebody does something like add a customer, they probably expect that customer to be in the next list that they request. So that's something to think about as well. Content negotiation we'll actually have a look at, but that's the idea of, I want this data, please, but I understand XML. And so your API will return it in an XML format, or I understand JSON, or I understand something like that. And that can be really powerful as well. That kind of opens it up to a lot more applications. If you don't want to do that kind of thing, then use JSON. Don't use XML. If you're going to use XML, wrap it in JSON. I'm kidding. Don't do that. That's ridiculous. So from an architectural perspective as well, I'm not going to tell you exactly how to write your architecture, but I'll kind of like quote some buzz phrases, like adhere to the principle of least surprise, which means like surprise is good. I've got Kinder up there. Anyway, surprise is good, but not when you're writing code against somebody else's API. You don't want to be writing it and just going, oh, that's not what I expected to get back. So when you're writing your API, make sure it's predictable. Help people fall into the pit of success. These are all awesome things. So make it really easy for somebody to get it right. Don't make them guess and look up the documentation every time they have to do something. The other one, be conservative in what you send, liberal in what you expect. I'm a little bit 50-50 on this one. That would be something like, if somebody hits my API, I can accept dates in four different formats, but I'm only ever going to send a date in one format, in the ISO format. If you don't do that, doesn't really matter. You can tell people, you know, you can dictate what people hit your API at, but, you know, that's something you might want to think about as well. Ultimately, it just kind of boils down to things like this. So have consistent URLs. If you're talking about customers, don't talk about order. So have consistent URLs. Don't make people guess what the URL for a particular resource is. Similarly, consistent objects. If they're asking for one customer, don't make it look completely different than the collection of customers. So just really basic things like that. Cool. So let's make one. How long have we got? We've got about 15 minutes, I think. Should be time. Has anybody got any questions just while I'm switching? Nope. You want to see me try to code? Well, that's good. So when I turned this on, I got here and I flicked over to my Windows thing, because this is a Mac. I flicked over to my Windows thing and it had a blue screen of death, and I went, oh, this is going to be great. Anyway, so what I'm going to do, we're going to do the canonical kind of hello world. So file new project. You know how I said that nobody does file new project? That's where I'm starting. And we're going to do a console app though, which is not something you'd imagine for you know, a web API, but this will hopefully give you an idea. So what are we doing? We're doing sample questions. So while I'm doing this, I'm just going to explain. My wife is a doctor. She just finished her final anesthetics exam, which means that now she can do something other than study and sleep and work. But as part of these exams, they have these short answer questions, and they're really simple things like, well, they're not. You'll see an example of them. But to help her out while she was studying, I made a little application where she can go and get a random set of eight questions, and then she can time herself and go through those questions and answer them properly. She had basically a massive resource of existing or past questions. So that's basically what I did. But I kind of did it in API first, just because I was doing this presentation. It kind of lined up nicely. So we have a console app. Doesn't do anything yet. So I'm going to... NuGet's been working really well for every presenter so far, so fingers crossed. So I'm going to install... I'm going to do those two commands that I mentioned before, and install Microsoft Owen self-host. So this is the Owen stack, that really lightweight kind of web layer that will self-host. So I don't need to run IIS, I don't need to run anything else like that. It's just going to create an HTTP listener and listen on an endpoint. And then I'm going to put Nancy over the top of that, which is a kind of a nice framework as well. So Nancy, and that is the Owen version of Nancy. So that's basically going to give me the ability to start up an endpoint in my console app. Now, if you're doing ASP.NET 5, it's a pretty similar paradigm. So have you been to many of the ASP.NET 5 talks? There's probably been a couple, yeah. This will look really familiar if you haven't used it. So we've got this using that. So a program, we're going to say, do this. Resharp will help me. And so we're going to listen on this port. So I need a startup file. Add, what am I doing? Add a new class. thankfully, Visual Studio knows what an Owen startup class looks like, so I don't have to. And in here, I'm just going to say, because I've added the Nancy stuff, I'm just going to say add use Nancy. So there's one more thing I have to do, and that's to define the Nancy module. So Nancy works with the idea of modules. They're really simple. You can fit a Nancy like application in a tweet. So what am I doing? So an API module, which inherits from Nancy module. Thank you. And then I'm also going to do this. Put in a new file. So the way that this works is in the constructor, you basically just define endpoints and say that get method for the just slash. So for that URL, I want you to return hello world. Cool. So that's it. I'm going to hit F5, and this is going to work first go because they always do. That's my start page. You like it? It's a thing called moment or something. So there you go. So that was file new project to a Hello World application. Who would say this is an API so far? No one. Good. Correct answer. So how about this? So this is going to break, by the way, to start off with. But now I'm not returning a string, I'm returning an object, and I'm returning an object, and let's try that again. But this is Nancy saying, you have asked for something, I don't know how to deliver it. And the reason is that we're using this idea of content negotiation. So when the browser makes a request, it says, I understand HTML. And Nancy is saying, I've got an object. I don't know how to turn that into an HTML file. It will look for some views, very much like MVC, but I don't have any of them, so it's going to fail. So what I can do is I can actually say, I want JSON. So this is one way of requesting JSON, just asking for a .json file. But the other way is using something like Postman. Does anyone use Postman? Awesome. That's like half the room. Cool. So I'm going to hit that, and it will send data like that. Now with the content negotiation stuff, I can also say I only accept application XML, and that's not going to work to start off with because it doesn't understand how to turn that into an object because it's anonymous. New good old ReSharper. It's the kind of there's a red bit, and so you press Alt Enter and it fixes it for you. I don't even need to know what's going on. Aren't you glad I don't write code for you? So if we go back to here and we say I want XML, it'll tell me there's an error generating the XML document. And the reason is ReSharper's smart, but it's not that smart, and it's given me a internal class. Again. Yeah. Right. So now we get an XML document. So this is the content negotiation side of it as well. Cool. So who would consider this an API now? A couple of hands. Okay. That's generous of you. We're returning objects. That's all fine. So let's actually return some real data. And I'm just going to cheat a little bit and call. Call this thing, which will just copy stuff for me, and then I can include it. Oh, no. I went to the wrong place. So that's when you write a script that moves stuff to the wrong spot. Oh, it shouldn't have. Okay, I created it in completely the wrong spot. I wonder where this is. Save as, where did I save this stuff? Demos. Good work, demo. So we'll put it here, and then we'll do this guy. Because I put it in the wrong spot again. even the copy-paste coding's not working. All right, there we go. So we're going to include these guys. So ignore that one for the moment. I'm also just going to make this an embedded resource. So this is my database, right? And normally you'd have a database or something behind the scenes, but this is basically just a JSON file. And you can see, like, a 75-year-old man requiring diuretic blocker for hypertension, bipivacaine, all this sort of... Like, this is the stuff that she had to know, which is why she doesn't remember me at the moment. So, and the other thing I'm going to do is install package NewtonSoft. I don't know why they don't just include this by default in every project you make. I suppose it's a console app, but still. No worries. All right, so all this does, basically, we've got a method that says get question. So this is kind of our business layer, right? I'm cheating a little bit. This is our business layer. We've got a get question, which will get one, and then we've got get random questions, and we give it a list of questions that we can get. And all it's doing is reading from that embedded resource and returning some stuff, right? So let's just change this constructor, sorry, the API module constructor. So we were just returning this get method. Instead, you're sick of me typing, I'm going to do that. So we've instantiating the repository, and again, don't do this, use dependency injection and stuff, but we've got two endpoints, an API questions, which will get 10 random questions, and then a questions with an ID, which will get a single one, okay? So let's, is this going to work yet? Apparently. All right, so we've got API questions. It's because I'm asking for XML. Let's turn that off and never turn it on again. So we've got a collection of 10 questions, right? So we've got our JSON object. If I go to one of those in particular, like 333, there we go. We see a fairly basic question about anesthetics. So we've got these two endpoints. So who would consider this an API now? We're getting a lot closer, right? Okay, we're nearly half the room. So this is kind of the RESTful endpoint, right? So we get some REST data back from this request. So I mentioned the HDOS style as well. So I'm going to add some other things in there. Oh, sorry, one more thing I wanted to show. So if I request one that's not there, I get a 404, but I've asked for JSON, and Nancy can give me a nice JSON response with a 404. So the status is actually 404 not found, which is an HTTP response, or a HTTP thing. What is it? Code? Status code? There we go. That's right there. HTTP status code. anyway, so that's a nice way of doing it as well. And we can see that negotiate, which means that if I ask for it in XML, it's going to give me this status code saying not found. So that's a little Nancy nicety. All right, so let's take this a little bit further. And we'll go to our short answer question object, which is just an ID in question. And we're going to add, again, you don't want me to type. So I've got this decorated one. So this is a kind of a naive, very manual way of doing this. There's other nice ways of doing this kind of linked style against your API, so against your REST objects. But basically, we're creating a constructor that will take that short answer question and then add this links object as well. And at the moment, we're just giving it a self-link. But you can imagine you might give it a link to similar questions or... you know, a collection of exam papers where that question has appeared and things like that. So you can add these other useful links. So the other thing I need to do, obviously, is return that object. So get random questions, select, I don't know why I chose T. Question, new decorated, short answer question, Q. So that'll return a decorated one for a single one. This one's a little bit more annoying. And the reason is that Nancy will turn this into a dynamic. It's not important, but it can be a little bit annoying. All right. So basically, we're saying if it's null, we'll still give a file a not found, but otherwise, we'll give a short answer question. So let's run this up again. How are we going? Cool. And we're going to hit this questions API again. And now we can see it's the same thing, but we've got this links collection. So now we're kind of doing a HDOS style one, right? So if we navigate to to these. So we want to have a look at question 306. We can go to there and request that one, and we get more detail. So you might want to return a bit more detail about the object you're returning as well. So does that kind of make sense? Who's on board? Are we in an API yet? Kind of. That's as much as you're going to get, by the way. Okay, cool. So we've got this API. I said API first, not API only. So let's do that. I'm gonna cheat a little bit. There's some weird stuff with Nancy where it doesn't understand stuff that's not copied to the build directory. There are other ways to do it with static files and things like that, but it's not important. So I'm gonna add jQuery. I'm going to add a view. So a views folder. Make sure it's views and not view. Yep, a views folder, and then in there I'm just going to add an HTML document. So one thing to note here is that I am adding an HTML document, not like a CSHTML or anything that takes an object. It's pure HTML. So that's important. And in here, nailed it. So you're just going to give 10 random questions. But what I'm doing after loading is I'm actually just hitting my API. And then I'm building this content in there. Cool? So my UI is just a layer over the top of my API. So I would access this exactly the same as everybody else. So let's do the same thing here and copy that. And the other thing I have to do, obviously, is I've got this API module that returns those things. Normally, I'd create like a UI module or some other module as well, but in this case, I'm just going to do this and say that will return a function which returns a view for index. So now when I hit this, it's going to look for a view and return that view, which is just the straight HTML document. All right. If this works first go, that's like 100%, kind of. Wasn't really, was it? All right. There we go. So we got our page with our data, which is cool. But what's important here is when you have a look at the traffic, we hit localhost and we get this HTML document, like with no data in it. But then we've hit our API and we've got this data back, right? And if we wanted to, we could add a hyperlink to one of these things, which will go to another page, which gives us that data as well. So that's all pretty cool. All right, does that all make sense? Any questions about the stuff that I've shown you? I mean, it's obviously demoware, so you can kind of see it's just hacked together. But that was like file new project through to an API-first UI layer that returns data from a data source in, 10 minutes, something like that. Any other questions before I do this other demo that I just added? Nope. Cool. All right. So for the people who say you never do a file new project, or the people who say yeah that's cool, the presenter gets up there, but they don't show stuff that's real. I'm not going to end up doing that. I've got this project here called My Amazing WinForms App. So when I was doing this demo, it took me about an hour to do the WinForms app because I can't remember how to do them. But it took me like 2 minutes to add an endpoint to it. So let's just give that a go. So we'll run this up. And we've got our WinForms app. Cool, huh? This is the student list. Doesn't do a lot yet. It's in beta. Sorry, it's in preview. We use preview now, not beta. So we've got our UI layer, and we've got our business layer, right? And again, I'm kind of cheating. My repository just has a list of students, and when I ask for get students, it returns these things. But you can see this is a WinForms app. That's the important thing. In the references, there's no web stuff in here at all. Like, there's no endpoint, there's no HTTP, there's nothing like that, right? So I'm going to run those same commands. I'm going to run install package. What is it? Microsoft Owin self-host. So again, doesn't need IIS, doesn't need anything really, it just opens up an HTTP endpoint for my Windows Forms app. And then I'm going to add Nancy on top as well. So Shouldn't have done that. Nancy Owen on top. So we get the same little help page and things like that. So I'll grab this guy, let that install. And in my program file, I'm just going to replace this application run with, I'm going to put it inside this using statement. So basically it's saying when this web app starts up, start up this localhost, but also dispose it when the application finishes running. That's all it's really doing. I'm going to call this like API startup instead. And then I'm going to create another Owen endpoint. Owen startup file, sorry. And I'm going to do exactly the same thing, app.useNancy. Did that finish? Did it do anything? Cool. It's attempting to make my demo work. Cool. There we go. Squiggles have gone away. So the other thing I obviously need to do in here, and I'll just do it in here, is have a Nancy endpoint. So, oops. Nancy module, and then we're going to do... And so our get method might be API students. And we're going to return a function, again, that returns, this is a terrible way of doing it, but student repository dot get students, for example. Never write your APIs like this, by the way. So this is going to instantiate a new student repository, get the students, and then return it, right? So I start it up, and we get the same thing. We've got our WinForms, right? But if I go to, did I use the same port? We get, we can't find the view, that's fine. We'll do it here. We get our students back. So that's a WinForms app which had no web stuff at all, and we just added to it in a couple of minutes. We added an HTTP endpoint. And all I did basically was put a really thin layer over my business layer. Cool. So the people who are not doing web stuff, you can see that this might actually still apply to you. You might be able to do it for your own WinForms or XAML apps and things like that. Cool. Any questions about those? No. Awesome. Must have been really, everything everybody needed to know about it. So, all right, so that's kind of me. So we talked about API, and hopefully I sold you on the idea of why an API might be useful, even if it is just an internal app. We looked at some of the implementation details, and there's a lot to that. If you're going to do this, do a bit of research, especially on things like security and versioning. Make sure you have a strategy, like, to start off with. And then finally, we had a look at some demos, and we built a couple. So that is me. Thank you.